This chapter records for us another instance of rebellion in the camp of Israel. Rebellion is of the devil. The devil is the arch rebel. It is he who instigates rebellion against God at every level in which that rebellion is seen. He is very resourceful in the variety of attacks that he launches upon the work of God. And time after time after time we have seen through Moses' ministry where there is attack after attack, and none of them really identical. There is a variety of weapons employed by the devil as he assaults the ministry of Moses and the work of God that Moses represented. One of the things the devil is very adept at is making use of the people of God to accomplish his purpose. I think if we might be allowed a little sanctified imagination, I think that it is something that the devil rejoices in more than anything else, if he can inflict damage on the cause of God by using the people of God. It's one thing for him to strike directly. It's another thing for him to strike against the church of Christ, using the wicked and the ungodly. But oh, how it must be such a delight to him to inflict damage on God's cause and God's servants using those from within the cause of God itself. Bitterness over their failure to enter into Canaan, as verse 13 and 14 indicates, had festered and really lay at the root of this rebellious activity on the part of Korah, Dathan and Abiram. Verse 13, Dathan and Abiram especially challenge Moses, accusing him of failure. You haven't brought us into a land of milk and honey. You brought us back out into the wilderness to kill us. Of course, that was a perverse view of events. It wasn't Moses' fault they weren't in Canaan. They weren't in Canaan because of their own sin. It was sin that had kept them out of Canaan. Previous instance of rebellion had perverted the thinking of the natural mind is. When you realize what is happening here, rebellion of heart had kept them out of Canaan, and yet that is now used as a reason to incite further rebellion. And how often that is the case, where even the consequences of sin are used in a perverted way by man's natural reasoning to justify further sin. Instead of it being an argument against sin and an argument for submission and surrender, the fact that we're in this mess because of previous sin, it's used to the very opposite end of inciting further hostility against God. Now you see in verse 2 and 3, let's just quickly look at the terms here that indicate the nature of this rebellion. They rose up before Moses. There is a swelling up, a standing up against Moses, standing up to him, to his face, in verse 2. Korah, 250 prominent individuals, princes we're told, famous, men of reputation in the congregation. They get on board this rebellion. They gather themselves together, verse 3, against Moses, against Aaron. Verse 10 and 11. They come against the Lord. They come against the Lord. The Psalm 106 makes reference to these events, and it tells us there in that psalm in the verse 16, they envied Moses also in the camp, and Aaron the saint of the Lord. He envied them. The word there that is used indicates a jealous rage, an anger, a passion, in which they became inflated. They swelled up with rage and zeal for their perverted cause, and it inflamed them to stand against Moses, Aaron, and against the Lord Himself. One of the dangers that God's people face as they come to look at a passage like this is the tendency to relegate these events to the dustbin of history. It happened all those thousands of years ago, and it doesn't really have a lot of relevance to us today. But this is not something that is confined to ancient history. It's not something that really was just a spirit of disgruntlement about Levitical order, and well, since we don't live in the age in this New Testament economy where Levitical regulation is in force, we don't really have much to learn from this. But that would be very wrong to think that. If you turn to the Epistle of Jude, the opening verses of that little epistle, written now clearly in a New Testament setting, Jude tells us in verse 3 that he had originally intended in his own heart to write an exposition of the gospel. And what a useful book that would have been to have. But he was led by the Spirit in a different direction, and though that was his original intention, he says, "It was needful for me to write unto you and to exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the faith, which was once delivered unto the saints." He's going to write against the forces of apostasy, exhorting God's people to take a stand for truth and for the faith, that once delivered faith. There's only one gospel. Only one message that God has ever delivered to mankind. It's to be stood for, contended for. The reason is given in verse 4. "For there are certain men crept in unawares, who were before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ." Jude is saying, even in the first century, even in first century Christianity, the church had been infiltrated by those who had come in unnoticed, bringing in a false gospel, false doctrine, worldly mindedness, this turning of grace into lasciviousness. Grace had become license, liberty to do what you like. Worldly mindedness was the doctrine that was being promoted in certain quarters in the Church of Christ. And many hadn't noticed. And so he's writing to turn the spotlight on these men. He gives us a number of identifying features. One of those is recorded in verse 11. "Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain." Now there's a fairly ancient illustration of sin, right back to the dawn of time. And yet Jude is saying there are men in the church today, and that's how they behave. You've got to watch for them. You haven't noticed them, but they're there. And not only do they go in the way of Cain, but let's bring in another illustration. They have ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward. That takes us to Moses' time, and a few chapters on in the book of Numbers. But for our purpose tonight, we want to notice the third mark that he mentions in this verse 11. They have perished in the gainsaying of Korah. In other words, Jude is telling us that there are men that have come into the church in his day, first century Christianity, in the age of the apostles, the Levitical economy has passed. But still within the church is the sin of Korah. And I make the point that there are lessons that we need to learn from Numbers chapter 16 for this very reason. Did Peter not become the enemy of Christ, rebuked for that in Matthew 16:23, when he, to some degree, was carried away with the logic that Korah used? Lord, you don't need to go to the cross. We'll see, as we look a little at Korah's rebellion here, you'll see that that really is getting awful close to where Korah stood when Peter spoke like that. You don't need to die. We don't need the cross. We can bypass the cross. Is it any wonder the Lord rebuked Peter for doing the work of the devil? If Peter can think this way, and Jude tells us that men of this caliber and thinking were in the church unnoticed at that time, we need to be put on our guard against the philosophy of Korah, because it can break out at any time among God's people. By attacking, as he did, especially the office of high priest and the priesthood that was attached to that, there is a direct attack launched here in Number 16 upon the gospel itself. You should never forget, we just read the words in Jude, that faith once delivered to the saints, behind the gospel or the scriptural revelation, the substance of it, one message. In the Old Testament, a different methodology employed to convey that message, but the same message. That one faith once delivered. Behind the pictures of the Levitical age is this one gospel message. And when Korah struck at the high priest's office, and when he struck at the priesthood and the significance of the Levitical priesthood, he was striking at the heart of the gospel itself. The matter here wasn't so much a personal one. Oh, personalities were involved. We can't avoid that. Moses was being criticized. Aaron was being blasted by these men in the camp of Israel. But as Moses reminds them in the verse 11, what is Aaron? What is Aaron that you murmur against him? It's not about the person. It's not about the personality. It was all about the function. It was all about the God-given function that Aaron executed as high priest, and the priesthood that was really dependent upon his high priesthood. That's what this is about. The principle of mediation. The principle of an intercessor between man and God being necessary. It's not about Aaron. It is an attack upon the divine institution that Aaron at this time represented. And consequently, it is an attack upon Christ himself as the one who is represented by Aaron, prefigured by Aaron, pictured and illustrated and proclaimed by Aaron's priesthood and the Levitical rites that Aaron headed at this time. In this chapter of the history of God's people, it's not about the man, but it's an attack upon the office. It's an attack upon the message revealed through that function. It's an attack upon Christ himself, and it's an attack, a rebellious defiance of God, God's order, God's Christ. It's an attack that can rise up even among the people of God today even from among the ranks of the church. As we have seen in the words of Jude, Korah's rebellion may repeat itself. These things are written for our learning and for our admonition. Now I want to look at the substance of this chapter. And to begin with, we're going to look at Korah's protest. Korah's protest. The heart of it is set before us in the verse 3. They gathered themselves together against Moses, against Aaron, and said unto them, Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Wherefore then lift ye up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord. The dominant feature of these words is, we do not need a mediator. That is the dominant feature of Korah's rebellion. All the congregation are holy. Every one of them. We don't need a high priest. We can take our worship into our own hands and in our own way, in our own determination, we can go to meet God as we please. That's the substance of what this was about. Korah devised an alternative way to approach God that bypassed God's provision of a mediator. The message of the Levitical age was personified in the function and office of the high priest. There is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. That, if we borrow Paul's New Testament words, is the message of the office of the high priest. That's what that all was about. The symbolism, the rites, the rituals, the pictures. There is one mediator, the man Christ Jesus. And this is what Korah is defying. We don't need a mediator. We can go to meet God on our own. We can come to stand to offer incense, which was, again, just a symbolic action of a sacred function exercised by the priesthood in Levitical times. It was the ministry of intercession, meeting God on the basis of the sacrifice on behalf of the people to pray for them. Korah says, we can do that ourselves, thank you. We'll deal with God our own way. He was determined to act as his own intercessor, to act as his own priest. Now that's what this is about. He accuses Moses and Aaron of pride. God's order, and that's what he's resisting here. Moses and Aaron were simply following God's pattern, God's order. Moses is a man, the meekest of all men. Isn't it interesting, just to, if you look here, Korah says to Moses, you're such an arrogant man. You have just imposed yourself upon the people. You've lifted yourself up, given yourself a sense of importance and a function that's not necessary. We don't need you. We don't need the institutions that God has appointed. And what does Moses do? He fell on his face. Far from being the man that he was accused of being, he falls on his face. Now Moses didn't deserve this criticism because, as I've said already, it wasn't about the man. It was about what Moses in his function and Aaron in his office represented as God's order. Korah's stand was widely supported. Verse 1 and 2 is Korah. He's supported by Dathan and Abiram, not from the tribe of Levi, but from the tribe of Reuben. Then we read in verse 2 the 250 princes of the assembly. I think it's a fair assumption that the rest of the tribes are all represented here, with so many tribes, or with so many princes, so many heads of households and families and sections of tribes. There's a significant part of the people represented. Verse 19, Korah gathered all the congregation against them unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So he has gathered all this assembly of supporters to witness his defiance of God's order. Verse 41, the next day after Korah's demise, we read that all of the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses. I have no doubt that there were many who naively and unwittingly were involved in supporting this and expressing sympathy with this, that really, when it came right down to it, didn't participate in Korah's rebellion. And I think that that is obvious from the fact that when Moses went to the majority of the people and said, "Up, separate yourselves, get away from the tents of Dathan and Abiram, because God's about to step in," they did. The reality is that in most instances, the vast majority of God's people are led around like sheep. Without a lot of thought, they follow along just whatever happens to be the prevailing breeze at the time. And there's something of that here. Jude warned the believers of his day, "You haven't noticed these men have come in. They're on the same mission Korah was on, and you haven't seen it." Oh, how lacking in discernment God's people are. Here is a brazen act of defiance of God, hostility to God's servants, and the people just seem to follow along without thinking. The scripture, not without reason, says, "Follow not the multitude to do evil." It's so easy to go along with the crowd, just to pick up on maybe one little part of the argument. You can imagine maybe a situation in the nation of Israel at this time, and maybe a day or two before, Moses had to be fairly stern with somebody that stepped out of line, and he said, "Here's God's way." And along comes Korah. He says his piece, and that man Moses had to rebuke, says, "You know that's right, Moses has become arrogant. He tore a strip off me the other day. I'm just going to stand where Korah stands, and we'll teach Moses a thing or two." And without really grasping the big picture, get on the wrong side. How careful we need to be about what we support, who we support, because it's so easy to get on the wrong side. These are matters we don't want to be on the wrong side, I can tell you. You read number 16 and you will recognize you don't want to be on the wrong side here. But Korah's stand, at least initially, was widely supported. He made his protest despite great spiritual privilege. And Moses reminds him of this. "Korah, you should know better. He's a Levite. He's been privileged in such a marvelous way. Verse 9, seemeth it but a small thing unto you that the God of Israel hath separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before him, stand before the congregation to minister unto him, and he hath brought thee near to him and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi with thee, and seek ye the priesthood also. Not content with what God had given. Not content with the place in God's hierarchy that he had put Korah in. It was a privileged position. But he wanted more. He wanted something different. He wanted the priesthood. Oh, that's devilish thinking. You know, God created the devil initially as one of the archangels. Exalted to the very highest station in heaven as far as the created order was concerned. But what rose up in his heart? I will be like the Most High. Not content. I want more. And that's the devilish spirit that shows itself here in Korah. Not content to be God's appointed minister, servant, before the congregation. I want to be the priest. I want to be my own mediator with God. Oh, that's a dangerous spirit. It's a devilish spirit. If we make application to the New Testament priesthood of believers, not content to serve and to minister in the way Christ has appointed, want to usurp his role, his authority, take his place. Well, we need to pray that God gives to us that humble, contrite heart at all times, just to serve where God has put us. Korah's crime is all the more heinous because of the privilege that he enjoyed, because of the knowledge that he had, because of the privileged position that he had been advanced to. He should have known better. He had lived for a little time already as the tabernacle had been erected and that functioning system of worship was now established for some little time. He knew he ought to have known much better than what he did. The sobering thing about Korah's protest is that such protesters against God's order must be prepared to take their stand before God. That's the sobering thing. You set yourself on a course of conflict and defiance with God's order, you need to be ready to face God on the basis of your convictions. As I was turning this over in my mind, here is something I think that imparts a sense of soberness and solemnity to this whole issue. You need to be sure of what you are convinced of. You need to be sure of your convictions, because you're going to have to carry those convictions into the presence of God and meet him on the basis of them. It's what Korah had to do. It wasn't just a question of getting on his high horse and challenging Moses and Aaron. It's not going to make a lot of difference, really. What are the consequences of that going to be? But Korah has to meet God. Verse 5 through to 7, and he spake unto Korah and unto all his company, saying, even tomorrow the Lord will show who are his and who is holy. Moses recognized, I think this is an interesting point. Moses recognized that this wasn't an argument he could win. He didn't even attempt. He didn't attempt to vindicate his own position. It's almost as if, in that meek spirit that he is famous in Scripture for, it's almost as if he says, well, whatever you like, Korah, tomorrow. I'm going to wait till tomorrow. I can't prove the point now. I have often encouraged you to put yourselves into the shoes of men like Moses. Imagine how Moses went to bed that night. If it had been me, I would have gone to bed fuming, wondering how I could have settled that. Not wishing to wait until tomorrow. But Moses was content to wait. Tomorrow. Tomorrow the Lord will show. It's not my place to vindicate my ministry, Moses is saying here. God is going to have to do that, and I'm going to wait His time to do that. Sometimes we have to wait a long time for our tomorrow. I have found myself recently recognizing this more and more. There are arguments I can't win. Somebody comes to me and shoots off at the mouth and accuses me of this, that, and the other. Well, I can say, no, I'm not guilty of those things. But at the end of the day, I can't win the argument. I'm just going to have to wait. Sometimes that's hard to do. We like to be vindicated. We like to be proved right. But sometimes we just have to wait until God's tomorrow. Verse 16 and 17, be thou and all thy company before the Lord. Thou, they, and Aaron, tomorrow. I'm going to let the Lord settle this. Here is the sobering reality of this situation. Where there is a disagreement with what God has revealed, God will settle it. One day. One day. There is no other way to conclusively settle it. And let us take away from this incident, this sobering understanding, that whatever spiritual views we profess, we must be prepared to face God on that basis. It is not a light thing. As it were, to run up a theological flag. It's easy to do. Oh, I believe this, and this is my conviction, and this is what... That's easy to say. But you're going to have to answer to God for those convictions. Korah discovered that. And Moses recognized, well, you can disagree with me. I can't win the argument. But tomorrow, I'll tell you what, tomorrow, let's all go meet God and let Him sort it out. Now you'll notice here that the wrath of God is revealed in this passage. The response of God to this wicked defiance of His order is truly frightening. As the apostle was to write, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. It is a fearful, sobering thing to challenge God's order. There was wrath against Dathan and Abiram. It appears that that was the first evidence. They were the first to fall under the wrath of God as it was revealed. And you'll find that recorded especially in verses 27 through to 34. These men were allies of Korah. they stubbornly supported Korah. In fact, they were so bent on defying Moses that they went a little further than Korah did, because they refused to comply with what we might describe as the disciplinary procedures that Moses was implementing for a proper settling of the dispute. All right, you come, let's go stand before God and let him as the judge arbitrate in the situation. That's what we could call, that's proper procedure. It's not that Moses was forcing them to do something untoward. It's not that he was being aggressively tyrannical. This is just proper procedure. But they dug their heels in and said, no, we're not going to cooperate. That's just about par for the course, believe me, to this day, even in dealing with sin among God's people. There are very few that once they start on a course like this are prepared to say, right, I'll cooperate with the procedures so that this can be settled and dealt with in a decent and orderly fashion. More often than not, it instantly turns to a defiance and, no, we're not going to cooperate. You want us to come and appear before a session? You want us to come and answer to a church court? No, sir. We are going just to throw up our hands in defiance, and we're not going to cooperate. I've seen in my limited experience of these things, seen that so many times. That's what Dathan and Abiram do. They dug in their heels. We're not going to cooperate. And that opposition proved to be fatal. It was fatal. One of the interesting features about the pouring out of God's judgment on this occasion is to see the role of Moses' prayer. Look at verse 15. Moses was very wroth and said unto the Lord, respect not thou their offering. Moses was angry, but he could still pray. This was not sinful anger. This was what the Bible describes as righteous indignation. It was already even a reflection in Moses of the anger of God. But you see what's happening? Moses, stirred by this righteous indignation, prays, Lord, you're going to have to do something. Respect not thou their offering. Do you know what that means? Don't accept it. And if God doesn't accept a man's offering, that man is damned. That man is ruined. Don't accept their offering. Here is a very serious prayer. There are saints today that would go weak at the knees even thinking about such a prayer being offered. God, step in and damn them. Because your honor is at stake. The gospel is at stake. Step in power and destroy them. That's a sobering prayer. Look at verse 29. Moses is speaking publicly to the people. Well, let's take verse 28. Moses said, hereby ye shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of mine own mind. If these men die the common death of all men, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Lord hath not sent me. But if the Lord make a new thing, and the earth open her mouth and swallow them up with all that appertaineth unto them, and they go down quick or alive into the pit, then ye shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord. In one sense, those verses give us an idea of what Moses was praying for. There is a prayer that runs parallel with this statement. This is what he is looking for God to do. I believe that this is a statement and a prayer that is informed by the direct revelation of God to him. Moses knew what he was talking about here. There was that conviction in his soul, this is what God is going to do. This is what Moses is looking for God to do. Open the earth and take them alive into hell. That's a sobering thing. Moses prayed, Lord, cut them off. I think we need to recognize that there does come a time when such prayers are necessary. When such is the assault of the devil upon the gospel and upon the work and person of Christ through men like Korah and Dathan and Abiram, it's time to pray. Bury them. Deal with them. Cut them off. I do not say that lightly. There are very few prayers like that in the Bible. And the men that prayed them were special men. It's not something to be approached lightly, but to be approached with a trembling heart. These words were prayed by a man whose first reaction was to get on his face before Korah, even as he was verbally abusing him. Wrath broke out against Dathan and Abiram. The earth opened her mouth, swallowed them. They made a brazen, defiant stand, even while the rest of the congregation separated themselves. We read in verse 27, these are tragic words. Dathan and Abiram came out and stood in the door of their tents, and their wives and their sons and their little children. See that? Their families standing by them. Their little ones. Their little ones. Induced by their father's rebellion to stand against God and going down alive into hell. This was just a precursor of what lay ahead, because this is the first phase of God's revelation of his wrath. That awful cry, verse 34, all Israel that were around about them fled at the cry of them. You imagine what that sounded like? There are sounds sometimes that we hear that have a particularly disturbing effect on us at the time that we never can forget. They live on in our memory. What a sound. The cry of souls in rebellion against God's order going down alive into hell. Can you even begin to think of the horror that must have gripped the minds of those men who to this point felt that we can thumb our nose at God, defy his order, defy his institutions. We can come to God. We're holy. We don't need a priest. We don't need those things. We can deal with God directly. Oh yes. What do they think now as God opens the ground beneath their feet? They go down alive into hell. It hardly bears thinking about. And yet that is the end of the course that these men pursued. Verse 35 tells us of Korah's doom. And there came out a fire from the Lord and consumed the 250 men that offered incense. Boldly Korah continues his stand against God. I do not know for sure whether these episodes were simultaneous, in that the earth opened and the fire came out from the presence of God at the same time. I don't know. They're recorded certainly consecutively, but recorded together. Suddenly God reveals his wrath, and Korah perishes. 250 men. They're in the place of worship. They have their censers in their hand. They're offering incense to God. In a sense, we can say they're worshiping. They're praying. But not according to God's order. They're insisting we can meet God in just the same way by following a different route. Oh, really? Fire. They ran into the fire of God. Korah's worship is refused. God is not obliged to accept just whatever men offer to him. I think that the common concept of God today is to read a passage like this. I guarantee you, you take this passage to the modern Christian and have them read it and have some understanding of it, and their reaction is going to be, God was very harsh. And they'll maybe even recite some of the rubbish that they've been taught about how glad we are we don't live with the God of the Old Testament. Yes, we do. Our God is still the same. Our God is a consuming fire, Hebrews 12 and 29. And he is to be approached according to his order. Oh, in mercy, the fire is so often withheld. There are few, if any, experiences of this kind today, but the fire is nonetheless real, and the fire will consume, because that worship that departs from God's order is simply not acceptable to him. And one day, men who go out to meet God on the basis of that conviction, I don't need God's high priest. I don't need God's instituted form of atonement. I can do it my own way. We'll discover fire that burns eternally. There's more wrath displayed the next day in verse 41 through to 49. I just want to bring this in here at this point, for the sake of covering all the evidences of God's displeasure on this occasion. The next day there is a further display of wrath as the congregation turn again to express sympathy for Korah. But on the morrow all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "Ye have killed the people of the Lord." You know, you need to be careful what you sympathize with and who you express sympathy for. Was there a sense in which the men of Israel could have sat down and wept for Korah? Yes. For it was the greatest tragedy that could befall any man. But there's a difference between weeping over the tragedy and murmuring out of sympathy for the people that God had cut off. Moses and Aaron didn't cut them off. God did that. You need to be careful what you sympathize with. Because you see, as soon as the congregation murmured in sympathy for Korah, Dathan and Abiram and all those others that perished, they immediately were placing themselves on Korah's side against God. and a plague breaks out among them. The glory of the Lord appeared, verse 42. Verse 46, Moses says to Aaron, "Go quickly, make an atonement for them, for there is wrath gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." Aaron runs, but as quick as he is, 14,700 men died. What for? Expressing sympathy with Korah. They sided with him. Posthumously, his rebellion lived on. It was picked up by those that weren't involved initially, in fact, who had been spared initially, and allowed by God to separate themselves, commanded by him, "Get away, step back till I deal with these men." And the next day, they sympathized. God strikes. Even that level of support is visited in a serious way by God. God does not take lightly any level of sympathy with those who defy him. He had said the day before, "Separate. Separate yourselves from them." Verse 24. "Get you up from about the tabernacle of Korah, Dathan and Abiram." Move away. Move away. Verse 26. "Depart, I pray you, from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest ye be consumed in all their sins." Don't touch. Here's a lesson in separation for God's people. There is a level of rebellion against God you don't want to have anything to do with. Where there is a defiance of God's order and God's gospel, you don't touch a thing. Where there is the presentation of a false gospel today, like Korah presented, don't touch a thing. Don't have anything to do with it. Don't have anything to do with it. You can hear the arguments, can you not? But Moses, he's a Levite. He's a professing servant of God. The parallel comes down to us today, but this is a church. This is a nice man. He makes such a nice pastor. If he's preaching Korah's message and has crept in unnoticed into the church, you don't touch him. Nothing to do with him. You don't listen to his radio program. You don't buy his books. You don't watch him on TV. You have nothing to do with him because he's the enemy of God. Here is a lesson to be remembered, and this is the final thought I'm going to leave you with tonight. A lesson to be remembered. The vital significance of atonement was impressed upon these men and women in Israel. Verse 36 through to 40, the brazen censers that Korah and his men had used, left untouched by the fire that consumed the men, gathered up, not recycled as censers, because there is a sense in which you can't pick up the garbage of false teaching and recycle it in the church. You can't do that. It was recycled in one sense. It was hammered into an entirely different shape and riveted to the altar as an ongoing reminder. This is where you meet God. And the function of the high priest and the dependent priesthood revolving around that brazen altar and the atonement that was made there, symbolically revealed in the sacrifices of the Old Testament economy. Of course, pointing forward to the work of Christ and the necessity of that one mediator between God and men. and his one sacrifice for sin forever. The lesson was to be riveted on the minds of those who looked at it as surely as the brazen plates were riveted to the altar. There's something not to be forgotten. The brazen altar. Was it? I don't know. It's just something that I threw out as a suggestion. Was the brazen altar, as it was originally designed and made, was it in some sense visually disfigured by the addition of these plates? You know how it is when you look at a renovation project, and sometimes the adding on of something extra spoils the original effect. I'm not going to dogmatically say that that was the case, but I think that there is a sense in which some may have said, you know, that spoiled the altar. Spoiled its original appearance. But the lesson was more important than any spoiling that may have taken place. The lesson is there visually impressed upon the people. Come by God's way to meet him, or you'll perish like the man who once held those censers. I love to look at historical artifacts. Not because I have a great knowledge of history, because I've always struggled to remember history. But I love that sense when you look at something or in the presence of something that has some connection with some great figure from history, and you know, you get the hair stands up on the back of your neck. Oh, you know, there's this sense of presence that King so-and-so touched this. This was his. You ever think that there were those who stood at the altar and looked at the brazen plates and the hair stood up on the back of their neck? As they thought, you know, there was a time when the brass of those plates was held in the hands of men who were damned because they defied God. That must have been a sobering thing to think about. God vindicated the high priest here. He vindicated the revealed way of approach to him. He riveted the censers, or what was left of them, to the altar. But he vindicated Aaron's function in a marvelous way, in two ways actually. Because you remember Moses said, all right, you and Aaron stand before God tomorrow. And there they were. But only Korah and his men perished. Aaron didn't die. Aaron was there when the fire fell. Aaron was standing right there. God is very selective in his judgment. God targets the fire. Aaron was there when the fire fell, and Aaron didn't perish, because Aaron represented the one way to God. Aaron's function was vindicated a little later in another way. Indeed, right through the whole episode, as repeatedly he and Moses stand between God and the people. The people are spared initially. Lord, are you going to cut off the whole congregation because one man sins? Verse 20 and following. They got between God and the people were spared. And Aaron's function was vindicated. The people sympathize with Korah on the day following. Moses says, Aaron, go get a censer. The significance here is such a wonderful thing. He got a censer. the very same thing Korah had in his hand. Korah took up a censer. God cut him off. Aaron took up a censer to pray for the people. And Aaron's work was recognized. And look at those. They're such marvelous words. Verse 48. He stood between the dead and the living. Now you think of what that means. Aaron put himself in harm's way. He put himself between the people and the plague that God was bringing upon the people. And Aaron was spared. And the people were spared. And his function was validated and vindicated, because that's God's way. God deals in mercy with men where there is a high priest, a mediator, as he has appointed. And again through this episode, the message is made very clear. There is life by God's high priest, and there's damnation without him. How quickly men forget these vital truths. God shook the earth and sent a significant number of men alive into hell. God sent fire and consumed 250 men at least in front of the tabernacle. And the next day, all the congregation had forgotten and we're starting on the same course again. There are those who object to the kind of ministry in the Church of Christ that highlights apostasy and the working of sin. It's not a necessary thing, they tell us. It's harping on some ancient old theme we don't need to hear anymore. If I could preach, I can't, but if I could preach to achieve the same effect as the fire of God coming out and damning 250 men and opening earth and all those of Dathan and Abiram's crowd going down alive into hell, if I could preach just once to have that effect, this passage means I would need to preach the same message the next day. They forgot. How quickly we forget the most stern, strident lessons that God sets before us. If we were eyewitnesses of those events, we would need number 16 preached again tomorrow. We would. Because we forget. There is nothing more important than that we have and maintain a clear understanding of God's gospel, the revealed way to do business with God. Deviate from that order. Bypass God's procedures. Following the course of Korah. There are those in the church, if I might conclude just by a repetition of Jude's warning, there are those in the church today, unnoticed by God's people, naively unaware that among them are those like Korah. They sympathize with them, they back them, they listen to them, they support them, unaware that that's the way to eternal ruin. We need to be on our guard. We need to pray for that spirit of discernment, that day after day, that today and tomorrow and the next day, God keeps these truths before us and helps us to be faithful to His revealed will.